Welcome back to Office Hours. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Kiffer. We're on lesson four today, nutrition, physical activity, and sleep. Three big topics in one lesson. And I want to start with the framing the module opens with.
Go.
For most of human history, the dominant nutritional public health concern was hunger. For most of the past 60 years in industrialized countries, the dominant concern has been overnutrition. And between those two endpoints sits basically the entire field of nutrition science.
And the lesson treats activity and sleep with the same kind of historical arc, each one a science that grew up in the 20th century.
Both physical activity epidemiology and sleep science have founding moments in 1953. Coincidentally, Jerry Morris's London bus drivers in November 1953 for physical activity and the Ossorinsky-Kleitman REM sleep paper in September 1953 for sleep. Three lifestyle fields, each with a similar shape to their development.
Connecting back to last lesson, germ theory, sanitation, vaccines, those are mostly the infectious disease story. This is the chronic disease story.
Right. The 20th century transition from infectious to chronic as the dominant cause of mortality in industrialized countries is the backdrop for everything in this lesson.
Okay. Section one, deficiency diseases, Lind and Goldberger.
Nutritional science begins with diseases caused by what people didn't eat. For centuries, sailors on long voyages developed scurvy. Populations dependent on polished white rice developed beriberi. Populations dependent on corn developed pellagra. Children dependent on inadequate milk developed rickets.
Start with Lind.
May 1747, aboard the British naval ship HMS Salisbury, a Scottish surgeon named James Lind conducted what's widely regarded as the first controlled clinical trial in medical history. Scurvy was a devastating problem for the Royal Navy, killing more sailors on long voyages than enemy action.
And the design?
He took 12 sailors with similar cases of scurvy, divided them into six pairs. Each pair got a different treatment, cider, elixir of vitriol, sulfuric acid, and alcohol, which sounds like a terrible idea, and was vinegar, seawater, oranges and lemons, and a paste of garlic, mustard, and horseradish.
Six interventions, all other conditions held constant.
As constant as he could manage, diet, bedding, ward, the lot. After 6 days, the pair receiving citrus fruits had recovered enough to nurse the other patients. None of the other pairs improved. And Lind's experiment is not a randomized trial in the modern sense. He didn't randomize, didn't blind, the sample was tiny. But it was a controlled comparison with a clear endpoint and a striking result.
And then it took the Royal Navy 48 years to actually adopt citrus rations.
Lind published in 1753. Royal Navy adopted citrus as standard practice in 1795, more than four decades later. The delay reflects everything that public health has subsequently learned about how slowly evidence translates into practice when entrenched interests, supply chain difficulties, and institutional inertia stand in the way. Once they finally implemented it, scurvy was essentially eliminated from the Royal Navy within a decade.
And Lind didn't know about vitamin C?
Vitamin C wasn't isolated for another 180 years. The general lesson, it's possible to identify effective interventions long before the underlying mechanism is understood, provided observation and comparison are disciplined. That's the same lesson we got from Snow Last Lesson.
Then a century and a half later, Goldberger and Pellagra.
Joseph Goldberger, American epidemiologist with the U.S. Public Health Service. Pellagra was an epidemic disease in the early 20th century American South, particularly among poor white sharecroppers and African Americans. By the 1910s, it was killing thousands of Americans each year. Characteristic symptoms of dermatitis, diarrhea, dementia, and often death.
And the dominant medical opinion was that it was infectious.
Goldberger was unconvinced. He observed that pellagra clustered in institutions, asylums, orphanages, prison farms, where the diet was monotonously corn-based. While the staff in those same institutions eating different food were not affected, he hypothesized it was a nutritional deficiency disease.
And he did a series of pretty dramatic interventions.
In an orphanage in Jackson, Mississippi, where pellagra was endemic, he introduced eggs, milk, and meat into the diet. Pellagra disappeared within weeks. In a Mississippi prison farm, he persuaded the warden to feed selected prisoners a monotonous corn-based diet, offering pardons in exchange. The prisoners developed pellagra on schedule, while controls did not.
And then the most striking part?
Filth parties. Goldberger and his collaborators, including his wife Mary and colleagues at the U.S. Public Health Service, injected themselves with blood from pellagra patients, swallowed scrapings from pellagra-affected skin. Otherwise demonstrated that pellagra wasn't contagious, none of them developed pellagra.
That's quite a commitment to one's hypothesis.
Yeah, and the specific deficiency wasn't identified in his lifetime. Niacin, vitamin B3, was isolated as the missing nutrient by Conrad Elvejem in 1937, 8 years after Goldberger's death. Pellagra was essentially eliminated in the U.S. by mandatory niacin fortification of flour in 1938.
And the lesson flags the ethical complexity.
Right. Goldberger's investigations are now taught both as a founding case of nutritional epidemiology and as a case study in research ethics. The orphans and prisoners he worked with didn't give informed consent in any modern sense, even though they appeared to benefit. The pre-Belmont, pre-TCPS landscape is the world he operated in.
Then, between roughly 1910 and 1950, vitamins get isolated.
Casimir Funk coined the term vitamin, originally vitamin, for vital amine in 1912. Thiamine, B1, isolated 1926, preventing beriberi. Riboflavin, B2, 1933. Vitamin C, isolated by Albert Szent-Györgyi in 1932, vitamin D in the 20s and 30s, vitamin A synthesized in 1937, folic acid characterized in 1941. Each isolation a significant scientific achievement. Collectively, one of the largest improvements in human welfare in the 20th century.
And the public health translation is food fortification.
Adding essential micronutrients to widely consumed staple foods. Iodization of salt began in Switzerland in 1924 and eliminated endemic goitre in regions where it had been a major problem for centuries. Vitamin D fortification of milk became widespread in the 30s and 40s. Canada made it mandatory in 1965, essentially eliminating rickets as a childhood disease in cold climate countries. Niacin fortification of flour in 1938 eliminated pellagra. And folic acid fortification of flour, mandatory in Canada from 1998, and the U.S. from 1998, has reduced neural tube defects by roughly 50% in newborns.
And the framing the lesson uses for fortification, it's a sanitary revolution descendant?
Yeah, large-scale, infrastructure-based, structurally implemented interventions that work without requiring individual action. The marginal cost of adding micronutrients to industrially produced staple foods is essentially zero. They reach populations that voluntary supplementation cannot. They operate continuously without requiring individual behavior change. Same general logic as building sewers.
And there are ethical questions about mandatory fortification.
Mandatory fortification modifies the food supply of every citizen without individual consent. The bar should be high, clear benefit, negligible individual harm, no realistic alternative for reaching the affected population. Policy implementation through transparent democratic processes. Most fortification programs meet that bar. Some proposed expansions, the calcium, vitamin B12, choline, omega-3, are still under discussion. And there's a small but vocal libertarian opposition to existing fortification.
And the deficiency framework isn't extinct.
Globally, far from it. Vitamin D deficiency is widespread, particularly in northern latitudes. Iron deficiency anemia affects approximately 25% of women of reproductive age globally. Iodine deficiency affects approximately 1.9 billion people. Vitamin A deficiency causes a quarter to half a million cases of childhood blindness per year globally. Even in Canada, there are subpopulations at risk, food insecure households, indigenous children in some communities, pregnant women in some immigrant communities, older adults in institutional care.
But the framework doesn't carry over to most modern nutritional problems.
That's the key bridge. Obesity, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and most contemporary chronic diseases are not deficiency diseases in any simple sense. They involve patterns of overconsumption, inadequate consumption of specific things, and structural mismatches between food environments and human metabolism. The methodological tools of deficiency disease nutrition don't always translate, which is the bridge to section two.
Section two, from undernutrition to overnutrition.
Within a single century, the dominant nutritional public health problem in most countries shifted from too few calories to too many. For about 95% of the existence of Homo sapiens, periodic hunger and chronic food insecurity were the norm. For about the last 70 years, in about the half of the world's population that lives in industrialized countries, food has been continuously abundant, energy dense, heavily processed, and aggressively marketed. The metabolic consequences are still being characterized. The political consequences are being fought over in real time.
Start with Ansel Keys.
Keys, 1904 to 2004, physiologist at the University of Minnesota, one of the most influential and most controversial figures in 20th century nutrition. He'd become interested in dietary fat during World War II. He was developing the K ration for American soldiers and observed that diet appeared to affect cardiovascular health. In the early 50s, he proposed the diet heart hypothesis, that saturated fat intake mediated through serum cholesterol caused atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease.
And to test the hypothesis at the population level, he launched the 7-country study.
1958, recruited middle-aged men from 16 cohorts in 7 countries, United States, Finland, Italy, Yugoslavia, Greece, the Netherlands, Japan, diet characterized in detail at the population level, cardiovascular events tracked prospectively, findings published initially in 1970 and elaborated over decades, strong associations between population-level saturated fat intake, serum cholesterol, and coronary heart disease mortality, Finland high, Greece and Japan low.
And the study is now contested in important ways.
Right. Country selection has been criticized as non-random and potentially confirmation biased. There were 22 countries with relevant data. Keyes selected 7. Other dietary factors, sugar, refined carbohydrates, ultra-processed food, weren't adequately controlled or characterized. The mechanistic story, saturated fat raises LDL cholesterol, which causes atherosclerosis, has been substantially refined. The relationship is more complex than Keyes' original model suggested.
But the basic claim has held up.
That's the thing to hold. Population-level dietary patterns affect cardiovascular disease. That has been confirmed by every subsequent cohort and trial. The specific operationalization, saturated fat is the central variable, has been substantially modified but not abandoned. And the Mediterranean diet pattern that Keyes identified as protective was validated in the pre-dimed trial in 2013 and remains the most evidence-based dietary pattern for chronic disease prevention.
Founding studies can be both partly wrong and centrally right.
That's a really good way to put it. And nutritional science requires patient incremental work over decades, not single decisive studies.
Then the obesity epidemic.
Through most of the 20th century, obesity was an individual clinical curiosity rather than a population health concern. The transition began in the late 70s and accelerated through the 80s. Adult obesity prevalence in the U.S., measured directly through NCHANES, tripled between 1975 and 2015, from approximately 12% to approximately 40%. Canadian rates are lower, but follow a similar trajectory. Direct measurement Canadian Health Measures survey data shows obesity prevalence rising from about 8% to about 27% between 1985 and 2019.
And the Popkin framework helps explain this globally.
Barry Popkin's nutrition transition, he describes the global shift through stages. Stage 1, hunger. Stage 2, receding famine. Calorie sufficiency reached, but with limited dietary diversity. Stage 3, degenerative diseases of nutrition, overconsumption of calories, fats, and refined carbohydrates. Stage 4, behavioral change, the policy and lifestyle response. The framework captures the global pattern. Most industrialized countries entered stage 3 in the late 20th century. Many lower and middle income countries are transitioning through stages 2 and 3 simultaneously now, with the result being both under and overnutrition coexisting in the same country and sometimes the same family.
And the lesson is honest that the proximate causes of the epidemic are well known.
Yeah, calories in, calories out. But that's a description, not a lever. The real levers are food marketing to children, ultra-processed food formulation, agricultural subsidies, the built environment, portion size norms, all of which involve confronting powerful industries with revenue at stake.
And there are structural interventions that have worked.
Mexico's sugar-sweetened beverage tax in 2014 is one of the cleanest examples. Measurable reductions in consumption, particularly among lower-income households. The UK's soft drinks industry levy in 2018, which drove reformulation of products by manufacturers. Chile's front-of-package warning labels in 2016. All exceptions that prove the rule. Structural interventions exist, but are politically expensive. Individual-level interventions, diet advice, and exercise programs are politically cheap, but on their own have shown modest population-level effects.
Then the 2016 sugar industry exposé.
This one's important for how it shaped trust in nutrition science. The Kearns, Schmidt, and Glantz paper in JAMA Internal Medicine in 2016 revealed that a foundational 1967 New England Journal of Medicine review minimizing sugar's role in heart disease had been funded by the Sugar Research Foundation. Two of the three authors had been paid by the foundation. The review shaped a generation of nutrition policy in a way that favored fat as the cardiovascular villain and minimized sugar.
And the implication is structural.
not really about individual researchers, about the structural pull of funding on which questions get asked, which outcomes get measured, which results get published. The corrective is not the elimination of industry funding, often impossible, but transparent disclosure, structural protection of research independence, and skeptical reading by trained scientists and informed citizens.
And then the ultra-processed food framework.
Tour development, a series of large cohort studies and recent randomized trials, Kevin Hall and colleagues 2019 is the most cited, have shown that ultra-processed food consumption causes weight gain and metabolic disturbance through mechanisms not reducible to caloric content alone. The NOVA classification system, developed by Carlos Montero and colleagues, divides foods into four categories by degree of processing, with ultra-processed at the top. Several countries are introducing ultra-processed food regulation. Canada's proposed front-of-package warning labels for foods high in saturated fat, sugar, and sodium will be mandatory by 2026.
And then GLP-1 drugs entered the picture.
Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro have become enormously consequential pharmaceuticals, and they've raised difficult questions about the appropriate role of pharmaceuticals in addressing what is fundamentally an environmental and structural problem. They work as substantial weight loss, improved metabolic markers, but they don't address the underlying environmental drivers. They raise their own equity questions about who can afford them. And they have interesting interactions with exercise that we're still figuring out, which we'll come back to in a minute.
Okay. Section 3, physical activity becomes a science.
And this one, I think students underestimate how recent the idea is that lack of physical activity is itself a health risk. Before about 1950, sedentary work was considered an advantage, a sign of having moved up the social ladder away from the physical labor of agricultural and industrial work. The science that turned this around begins with a London Transit study.
Jeremy Morris.
British public health physician with a particular interest in social class gradients in disease. In the early 50s, he was looking for a way to test whether physical activity itself, independent of social class, diet, and other factors, affected cardiovascular disease risk. The London Transport Authority offered an ideal natural experiment.
Tell me about the buses.
Double-decker buses of London in the 50s were staffed by two-person crews, a driver who sat at the wheel for an 8-hour shift, and a conductor who collected fares and managed passenger flow by climbing up and down the stairs of the double-decker many times per shift. Driver and conductor, drawn from the same socioeconomic background, ate at the same canteens, lived in similar neighborhoods, same workplace conditions. They differed primarily in physical activity. The conductor climbed an estimated 600 plus stairs per shift. The driver was essentially stationary all day.
Beautiful natural experiment.
Morris and colleagues compared coronary heart disease rates between drivers and conductors. Results published in The Lancet, November 1953. Drivers had approximately double the rate of coronary heart disease compared with conductors. Sudden cardiac death was particularly elevated among drivers. The pattern persisted after controlling for the factors known at the time to influence cardiovascular risk. Physical activity itself, Morris concluded, was protective.
And the methodological caveats?
Real and worth flagging, the biggest is healthy worker selection. Men who were already healthy enough for the physically demanding conductor job might have been at lower cardiovascular risk to start with. Men with early disease might have self-selected into the sedentary driver role. Morris was aware of this and noted that even within job categories, more active workers had lower rates. The modern way to address selection is randomized trials of exercise interventions, which have replicated the protective effect at smaller scale, and Mendelian randomization studies using genetic variants associated with activity levels.
So the Morris study is best understood as
hypothesis generating, not definitive. But it motivated a 70-year research program that has produced a robust evidence base. Morris himself continued working in physical activity epidemiology until his death at age 99, having essentially proved his own hypothesis through personal example.
Then the field developed.
Progressively expanded what it measured. Early studies focused on exercise, intentional physical activity for fitness. Subsequent work expanded to physical activity more broadly, including occupational activity, active transport, household activity. Most recently, the field has identified sedentary behavior, prolonged sitting, as an independent risk factor. Not just the absence of physical activity, its own thing.
The active couch potato phenomenon.
Right. A person who exercises vigorously for 30 minutes per day but sits for 14 hours otherwise, the modern office worker, has a different risk profile from a person with the same exercise dose who walks and stands throughout the day. The active couch potato pattern has been characterized in multiple cohort studies as carrying elevated cardiovascular and metabolic risk, even with adequate exercise. Conversely, light intensity activity throughout the day appears to confer health benefits not reducible to formal exercise.
And the Canadian framework reflects this.
The Canadian 24-hour movement guidelines from the Canadian Society for Exercise Physiology in 2020 integrated targets for moderate to vigorous physical activity, 150 minutes per week for adults, muscle strengthening twice weekly, sleep duration of 7 to 9 hours, and sedentary time limited, specifically no more than 8 hours of sitting per day with no more than 3 hours of recreational screen time. The framework treats the day as a fixed resource that has to be allocated among activity, sleep, and sedentary time, rather than treating each in isolation. Methodologically innovative.
And the dose response on exercise is well characterized.
150 minutes per week of moderate intensity activity, the WHO and Canadian recommendation, produces substantial cardiovascular, metabolic, mental health, and mortality benefits. Continuing returns up to much higher doses. Effect sizes are large. Meeting the activity guideline is associated with roughly 30% reduction in all-cause mortality in observational studies with appropriate adjustment for selection effects.
Exercise is the best buy in public health.
Morris coined that phrase late in his career, and it's true on the evidence, but, and this is the recurring tension in this whole lesson, the intervention question is harder than the evidence question. Individual level interventions like exercise prescriptions, behavioral counseling, gym memberships, fitness apps have modest population level effects. Most adults who join gyms in January don't remain active by March. Most exercise prescriptions are not filled. Most fitness apps are abandoned within months.
And the structural interventions are politically harder.
But they produce larger and more durable effects, built environments that make active transport convenient, school physical education programs that reach all children, workplace policies that allow movement throughout the day. The international comparison is striking. Countries that designed for active transport, the Netherlands, Denmark, parts of Japan, have substantially higher population activity levels with no specific exercise program. Cities like Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal have introduced cycling infrastructure investments, walkable neighborhood policies, transit-oriented development that over decades is shifting activity patterns.
That arc, individual to structural, keeps repeating across the lesson.
It's the same arc as nutrition, individual dietary advice to fortification, taxes, marketing restrictions, same arc as tobacco, individual quit advice to taxation, advertising bans, smoke-free environments. In each case, the individual approach is politically cheaper and easier, but less effective. The structural approach is politically more difficult, but more effective at scale. The lesson is general and recurring.
And one more note before we move to sleep, GLP-1 drugs and exercise.
Early evidence suggests that pharmaceutical weight loss without concurrent exercise produces disproportionate loss of muscle mass with implications for long-term function. The contemporary recommendation is exercise alongside, not instead of GLP-1 therapy. But the integration of pharmacology and physical activity is an active research and clinical frontier.
Okay, section 4, sleep, the newest of the lifestyle sciences.
And the two foundational discoveries, REM sleep in 1953 and the molecular machinery of circadian rhythms, Nobel Prize 2017, both happened in living memory. Sleep is now established as a fundamental physiological process with substantial health consequences when disrupted. But sleep is also the hardest of the three lifestyle factors to intervene on at the population level. It intersects with work scheduling, school start times, light pollution, social structure, and economic precarity in ways no single public health agency owns.
REM sleep first.
For most of human history, sleep was treated as a uniform state of unconsciousness, passive, restorative, not worth scientific investigation. Then in 1953, in the lab of Nathaniel Kleitman at the University of Chicago, his graduate student Eugene Ossorinsky was monitoring a sleeping subject's eye movements with an electrooculogram. He observed that the eyes underwent periods of rapid coordinated movement followed by stillness, and that these periods correlated with vivid dreaming when the subject was awoken during them.
And the paper?
Ossorinsky, Kleitman, Science, September 1953, described rapid eye movement, REM, sleep as a distinct sleep state alternating with non-REM sleep across the night, launched the entire field of sleep medicine. Modern sleep architecture, REM/NREM cycles, slow wave sleep, sleep stages, all descends from this work. Ossorinsky, who completed his PhD on the topic, didn't initially recognize the importance of his own discovery. He left the field for a decade before returning to it.
And what does REM actually do?
Still partly debated. REM is associated with vivid dreaming, with memory consolidation, particularly emotional and procedural memory, with synaptic remodeling, with regulation of mood and emotional processing. People deprived of REM sleep specifically, typically through medication-induced REM suppression, develop measurable cognitive and emotional disruption. And after sleep restriction, animals and humans recover lost REM disproportionately when subsequent sleep is allowed, suggesting a homeostatic function the body actively protects.
And the downstream consequence, sleep medicine.
Emerged as a clinical specialty in the 60s and 70s, polysomnography, multi-channel recording of sleep stages, eye movements, muscle tone, heart rate, breathing, became standard. Diagnostic categories established, narcolepsy, sleep apnea, REM behavior disorder, restless leg syndrome. And most importantly for our purposes, sleep became a population health concern, not just a clinical curiosity.
And then the other foundational discovery, circadian biology?
2017 Nobel Prize, Jeffrey Hall, Michael Rosbach, Michael Young. The phenomenon of circadian rhythm, biological cycles of roughly 24 hours persisting even in the absence of environmental cues, had been observed since antiquity. The molecular machinery was a mystery until the 1980s. Working with the fruit fly Drosophila, they identified a network of genes, period, timeless, clock, cycle, and mammalian analogs BMAL1, PERCRY, that produce proteins on a roughly 24-hour cycle through transcription-translation feedback loops.
And the mechanism is conserved across organisms.
Essentially, every multicellular organism. Each cell of your body has a molecular clock. Tissue-level coordination is maintained by the suprachiasmatic nucleus of the hypothalamus, which receives input from retinal light-sensing pathways and synchronizes peripheral clocks. The clinical implications are enormous and still being processed.
Walk us through some.
Sleep timing matters as well as sleep duration. The pre-sleep light environment, particularly blue spectrum light from screens, affects melatonin secretion and sleep onset. Eating patterns interact with circadian biology in ways that affect metabolism. Early eating with the largest meal at midday is consistently associated with better metabolic outcomes than late eating. Medications can have substantially different effects depending on the time of day they're administered. A field called chronopharmacology, now integrating into oncology, cardiology, and other specialties.
And shift work.
Shift work is a chronic circadian disruption. The International Agency for Research on Cancer classified night shift work as a probable carcinogen, group 2A, in 2007, based primarily on accumulating evidence of elevated breast cancer risk in long-term night shift workers. The mechanisms include melatonin suppression by light exposure at night, sleep disruption, and circadian misalignment with eating and activity patterns. The evidentiary picture is still being refined, but shift work joins a small list of occupational exposures formally recognized as cancer risks.
And we have shift work all over the labor force.
Healthcare workers, first responders, truck drivers, manufacturing, retail, hospitality, roughly 15 to 20% of the labor force in industrialized countries works some form of shift schedule. And the protective interventions, limited consecutive night shifts, forward rotating schedules, controlled light environments are inconsistently implemented.
And the population health implications of inadequate sleep generally.
Sleep duration tracks with cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, depression, cognitive function, immune function, accident rates. The dose response curve has a U-shape, but both short sleep under 6 hours and long sleep over 9 hours are associated with worse outcomes than the middle of the range. The 7 to 9 hour recommendation in the Canadian 24-hour movement guidelines reflects this, and short sleep is increasing in industrialized populations. Average sleep duration in U.S. adults has dropped by roughly an hour over the past 50 years. Adolescent sleep is particularly compromised, averages well below recommended ranges, with school start times being one of the largest single drivers.
And the policy infrastructure for sleep is?
Barely existent, the science is solid, the interventions are mostly individual. Sleep hygiene recommendations, blue light filters, melatonin supplementation, sometimes cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. The structural interventions that would work at scale, later school start times for adolescents, reduced shift work or better designed shifts, light pollution regulation, work scheduling reforms, exist only in pockets. Some U.S. school districts have implemented later high school start times with measurable improvements in adolescent sleep and academic performance. Canada is mostly watching.
Sleep as a social determinant of health.
That's the framing the lesson lands on. Sleep is unevenly distributed by socioeconomic position. Lower-income workers have more shift work, more sleep-disturbing housing conditions, more financial stress that affects sleep, and less access to interventions like quality bedding or quiet sleep environments. Sleep inequity tracks income inequity in ways the field is only beginning to map.
Let me try to pull this lesson together. 8 quick takeaways.
Go.
First, nutritional science begins with deficiency diseases. Lindon scurvy in 1747, the first controlled clinical trial. Goldberger on pellagra in the 1910s. And the vitamin discoveries between 1910 and 1950 that produced the fortification programs.
Second, food fortification is one of the most cost-effective public health interventions ever devised. It's structural, infrastructure-based, doesn't require individual behavior change. Folic acid fortification in 1998 cut neural tube defects roughly in half. The deficiency framework still matters globally and in specific Canadian subpopulations.
Third, the dominant nutritional problem in industrialized countries shifted from undernutrition to overnutrition over the 20th century. Ansel Keys' 7 countries study is partly wrong on the details, but centrally right that population-level dietary patterns affect cardiovascular disease.
Fourth, the obesity epidemic since 1980 has roughly tripled adult obesity prevalence in the U.S. and more than tripled it in Canada. The proximate causes are well known, the structural interventions that would address them, sugar taxes, marketing restrictions, front of package labels, ultra-processed food regulation are politically expensive. The 2016 sugar industry exposé reminds us that funding shapes what science gets done.
Fifth, physical activity epidemiology starts with Jerry Morris's London Bus Drivers in 1953. Sedentary drivers had about double the coronary heart disease rate of stair-climbing conductors. The field has expanded to include sedentary behavior as an independent risk factor, and the Canadian 24-hour movement guidelines treat activity, sleep, and sedentary time as one integrated package.
Sixth, exercise is the best buy in public health on the evidence, but individual-level interventions have modest population effects. Structural interventions on the built environment are politically harder but more effective. Same arc as nutrition, same arc as tobacco.
Seventh, sleep science as a field is 60 years young. REM discovered in 1953. Circadian biology cracked at the molecular level in the 80s and recognized with the 2017 Nobel. Shift work is now recognized as a probable carcinogen. The science is solid. The policy infrastructure barely exists.
And eighth, the recurring tension across all three topics is between individual level interventions and structural change. The structural interventions work better and are politically harder. Recognizing the difference and pushing for the structural where possible is part of what distinguishes a careful contemporary public health practitioner.
And the capstone milestone this week, students take their topic and add the lifestyle dimensions.
What does the modifiable lifestyle landscape look like for your topic? Nutrition, activity, sleep? Which of them matter? What's the evidence? What individual versus structural interventions have been tried? That's week 4.
Next lesson, we move into sexual and reproductive health. That's lesson 5.
Read the module, do the knowledge checks, bring the reflections that didn't resolve cleanly.
Thanks for listening. See you in lesson 5.
Take care of yourselves. See you in class.